sharing the pain, but also still aware that it's only going to get worse. We need to escape, and soon. But how? We're being held in an oversized stone tomb, which is no doubt guarded by handfuls of Cognatan warriors, on a world where running the few miles back to the lander will take several exhausting hours. Gal is still out there, no doubt assessing the situation and working on a way to help us. But I'm not sure the combined might of her drones will be enough to overwhelm the powerful Cognatans.
How the hell did we end up here? I ask.
It's a rhetorical question, but Capria takes it seriously. Sniffling back tears, she says,
What do you mean?
A day ago, we were on Earth, in a paradise, and rather than staying there, we're here, captured by the descendants of our crewmates, facing their same horrible fate. It's too much, too fast. The pacing is wrong. Life doesn't move like this.
We're not really alive, Capria says, remember? And we're cheating. It should have taken us 10 years of FTL travel to reach Cognata.
A laugh huffs from my lips when I remember something my mother used to tell me.
Cheaters never win.
Tom disagreed with that notion, she says. But look at how things turned out for him.
Maybe, I say. It's just... I feel like we're stuck in fast forward. Our lives are a series of events, most of them not too pleasant.
Ready for the great escape? She asks. For two?
I don't know.
Could we have had a real-life great escape on Earth? Or would Antarctica prove to be populated by savage penguins with tentacles? The one thing I'm sure of is that we should have stayed and found out. Screw the Galahad. Screw our mission. Screw all the unanswered questions. If we survive this mess, we're going to just live and be happy. A cool breeze tickles the back of my neck, sending a shiver through my body. Capria leans back.
What is it?
A draft.
I scan the vast space for windows, but find none. The solid door is so well crafted that its seam along all sides is hard to see. The orange light allows us to see the tapestries well enough, but the corners of the room are cast in shadow. I wrench one of the crystals from its post and make a hasty search of the room.
Nothing.
Like the doors, the walls are all built from large stones, perfectly shaped, like a puzzle.
Then where?
A torrent of cool air, like stepping under an invisible waterfall, draws my eyes upward. The ceiling is vented, allowing fresh air in and moisture to get out, preventing mold growth. But how big is the opening? I doubt it's large enough for one of the broad-shouldered Cognatans, but Capria and I are far more slender.
We might be able to...
The doors at the front of the keep thunk. The lock has been disengaged. I wave Capria to the wall, ready to hoist her up, but before she can place her foot in my extended fingers, the doors crash open. The large Cognatan, standing a full 5 feet tall and nearly as wide, is a barrel-chested female, but unlike the well-dressed women we saw on our way to the keep, this one is dressed in gilded armor. A shield is mounted to her back, and a sword hangs from her hip. This must be the Kosna that Rawl spoke of, the matriarch of Renfro.
If we can kill her, I whisper to Capria.
Her eyes go wide.
Kill her? Look at her. It might be our only chance to claim dominance.
Or get us killed faster.
What would be better than being...
No talk, Kosna says.
Her deep voice vibrates inside my chest. She strokes the braided hair hanging from her cheeks, giving us a careful once-over. Her footsteps, buffered by the furs lining the floor, still manage to shake the stone beneath us. She approaches with a lack of caution, but keeps a hand on her sword's handle.
You, lords.
I shake my head.
Not lords.
She stops a few feet short, close enough for me to smell her fishy breath. She squints at my face.
Then what?
I search for an answer that will make sense but can't speak, and not just because I can't think of the words. Kosna draws her sword faster than should be possible for such a stocky woman. The blade sings through the air and then through my throat. Cosna wipes the blade clean on her leather-clad leg, sheathes it, and waits patiently while my gurgling gasps fade and the wound heals. When I'm breathing normally again and not bleeding out all over myself, she points at me.
Lord of Lies.
She turns her attention to Capria, reaches out and grazes her cheek with a thick finger. Then she grasps Capria's coverall and yanks. The magnetic seal opens and the loose-fitting garment peels downward, revealing tight-fitting thermals. Cosna gazes at Capria with hungry eyes that I'm not sure have anything to do with a feast, and it's all I can take. Fighting against gravity, I lunge around Cosna's broad body, leaping onto her back and wrap my arms around her thick neck. Latching my arms, I flex and squeeze with every ounce of strength I possess, bracing myself for a thrashing. But Cosna doesn't fight. She simply turns her head and looks back at me.
You hug?
My actions are having so little effect on her that she hasn't recognized them as violent.
No, she says. Lord of Lies attacks.
When she draws her sword again, there's nothing I can do to stop her. But she doesn't try to assault me with the blade. Instead, she plunges it into Capria's gut. The blade punches through her body, coming out the far side, coated in red. Capria's eyes meet mine as she crumples to the floor, hands clutching the sword's hilt. My heart breaks for her. Not because of the pain she's suffering, or because she might die temporarily, but because I can see in her eyes that she wishes this would be the end, that she wouldn't wake up.
45. No!
I spot a bit of flesh in the mass of hair flowing from Kozna's head and face. Like a beast, I bite down on it, getting a mouthful of hair and what turns out to be a thick ear. Cosna roars in pain as I taste blood, but my assault is short-lived. The matriarch reaches over her back, grasps my coveralls, and throws me against the stone wall. I crumple to the floor, concussed, but still conscious. Cosna wears a lopsided grin. She rubs her ear, hand coming away slick with blood. She bends down over me and traces her wet fingers across both cheeks, either decorating me or marking me.
You, we eat. She,
Cosna places her thick hand on Capria's thigh, giving her a shake.
I keep.
Capria screams, her voice booming out from some deep reservoir of rage. She pulls the long blade from her stomach, inflicting even more damage to her body, but knowing it will heal. Even Cosna looks surprised, and in the moment of distraction, I kick, hard. My heel collides with the cognatin's thick nose. She reels back, blood pouring, filling the air with a still human scent of copper. I draw my leg back to kick again, but a blood-soaked Capria is there, shouting a battle cry and diving forward, sword in hand. The blade stabs toward Kozna's chest, a killing blow, but strikes armor plating and deflects away. There's not even a scratch left behind. Still clutching her bloodied nose, Cosna swings a thick backhand, connecting with Capria's side and sprawling her to the ground. The sword clatters away. Fully healed, I attempt a different tack, driving my fist at Kozna's face. I might not outmuscle her, but I've got height and reach on my side. I connect with her nose again, drawing a howl of pain. My second punch is slapped away by her meaty hand with enough force to fracture my arm. Vision goes dark from the pain. I stumble back, making it just two steps before Cosna barrels into me, hoists me in the air, and slams me against the wall. I simply give myself over to the dark abyss of death and wait for the pain of rebirth. I'm not sure how long it takes to come back, but it can't be long. Capria is on her feet again, holding the sword, facing down Cosna, who is slowly stalking her.
Cosna,
a voice says from the entrance. It's a short warrior, spear in hand, with several more behind him.
Need help? Away,
Cosna roars. And the warrior slinks away, back into the orange-lit night. Capria takes advantage of the distraction, swinging the sword in a wide arc. Cosna blocks the blow with her shield, now mounted on her arm instead of her back. Laughing, she reaches her hand out for Capria's head. The thick digits, capable of crushing a human skull, are extended one moment, and then in the next, falling to the floor. Capria has heaved the heavy sword in the other direction, severing the fingers. Cosna seems stunned, looking from her hands to her fingers lying on the floor. She's no stranger to pain, but I don't think she's ever experienced a wound like this before. But her confusion has nothing to do with the strangeness of being separated from her fingers, and more to do with the fact that they're growing back. The regeneration is slower than mine or Capria's, but it appears Cosna has inherited the trait from her Galahadian ancestors, or perhaps acquired them upon eating their immortal flesh. Doesn't matter. What does matter is that we're never going to get a better chance. I crawl across the floor using one arm, and when the other heals, I pick up the glowing orange crystal. It's heavy and hard in my hand. I stand up slowly, mostly because it's all I can manage, but Capria sees me and starts swinging the sword wildly, using all her energy, but driving Cosna back. This time, when I leap on the broad back, I wrap just a single arm around the uncrushable neck. With my free hand, I strike, driving the hard crystal into Cosna's thick skull. The first two strikes appear to have no effect, but the third cracks something and drops the matriarch to one knee. The crystal's glow is diminished by the thick blood coating it. I drive it again, but this time my hand is caught. Once again I find myself propelled through the air upside down, but this time I collide with the floor rather than a wall, and I manage to stay both uninjured and conscious. I stand behind Capria, who still holds the sword, but is weighed down by it. We face off with Cosna, whose fingers are nearly finished regenerating. She stands again, looking as strong as ever. I point at her, hoping a war of words will have a more profound effect.
Cosna, Lord.
She shakes her head with a grunt.
No. Lord of lies both.
I thump a fist against my chest.
You like me.
I point to the mural depicting the Galahad's crew being eaten.
Like them.
Cosna snarls, looks down at her severed digits on the floor. She lifts her wide foot and slams it down on the fingers, smearing the flesh to paste, smothering the evidence. Then she turns her head toward the door.
She's going to shout for help, I say.
Capria dives forward, swinging the sword. Sparks fly as the blade and shield collide. Cosna opens her mouth, and I do the only thing I can think of. I hurl the crystal. It bounces off her thick, now-healed skull. She takes a moment to laugh at me while Capria does her best to lift the sword again, battling exhaustion more than Cosna now. But there's nothing we can do to stop her. As the first squawk of Cosna's voice fills the chamber, it's cut short by a blur of black motion. Cosna stumbles back, clutching her throat, eyeing the ruined object now lying on the floor. It's a small drone, destroyed by the collision. But where there is one drone, there are more. There is Gal. Shouts erupt outside the keep, growing louder. But it's not Cognatin warriors who charge through the open doors. It's 12 drones moving fast, the blue glow of their repulse discs mingling with the orange light to create overlapping streaks of luminous brown. They hum loudly, buzzing around Cosna, who appears mortified by the futuristic devices. But all of the swarming drones are just a distraction for the largest of them, cruising through the door, making a wide arc through the keep, and plowing its girth into Cosna. The Cognata leader is lifted off her feet and slammed into the wall with all the force the engineering drone can muster, and it's more than the wall can handle. Stones grind and give way, toppling the wall out into the dark night and atop Cosna, who's going to have a lot of explaining to do when she emerges from the tons of crushing stone unharmed. Despite Cosna's sudden and dramatic defeat, the scene outside the keep doesn't convince me that surviving our fate is possible. A large courtyard has been revealed. At the center of it are 6 stakes, each accompanied by a statue vaguely resembling our 6 consumed crewmates. They've commemorated the event that freed them from tyranny, probably made a holiday of it. Given the new restraints attached to 2 of the posts, the ceremonial table lined with carving tools, and the long line already leading far into the distance, they are eager to repeat the ceremony with actual lords. Thousands of beefy, slack-jawed Cognatins stare at the crumbled wall, their fallen matriarch and the 2 lords standing in the opening.
There's no way, Capria says.
I think she's accurately captured the futility of this moment. Even with Gal's help, we'll never be able to fight our way out of here. Thankfully, Gal is planning to fight. Get on, Gal shouts from two of the larger drones lowering their thick, round frames beside us.
Get on, I say. Are you serious?
Capria drops the heavy sword and dives atop one of the drones clutching the sides. Then she's speeding away, flanked by a number of smaller drones. The stunned cognatins shrink back, but then, perhaps realizing the lords they were about to eat might escape, they draw their weapons.
Get on, Gal shouts.
I leap atop the drone, held in place as much by the excess gravity as my white-knuckled grip. The repulse discs hum to life, and then I'm moving. But unlike Capria's flight through the city, I don't have surprise on my side. But I'm not alone, either. Six smaller drones buzz around me, and as I cruise across the courtyard, they move to intercept the barrage of projectiles already soaring my way. Stones, spears, and arrows are deflected by the drones, whipping and buzzing about like angry wasps, taking hits that were intended for me. The initial attack leaves one drone on the ground and another spinning wildly away, exploding when it careens into a stone wall. The blast makes most of the cognatins duck for cover, but the more seasoned fighters, including Rolf, push the attack. An arrow shot by Rolf slips past my defenders and punches through my calf. The sudden pain nearly pries me from the drone's back, but I manage to hold on. Far ahead, Capria and her mechanical steed cruise through Renfro's closing gates free and clear. I'm relieved that she escaped, but my fate is sealed, along with the massive metal doors. Pelted with stones hurled by throngs of everyday cognatins, I shout, "Gal, the wall!"
"I see it," she says, still heading straight for the 5-foot-thick barricade, seconds away from crashing.
The drone hums a little louder and we peel away from the ground, slowly gaining altitude as we approach the wall.
"Higher!"
I shout, and then a jolt. The drone is struck by something. The steady hum of the repulse disc becomes a sputtering buzz. I see the collision before it happens. It will no doubt result in my temporary death, followed by a slow, agonizing permanent death in the bellies of thousands of cognatins, including Kozna, who I can hear shouting orders in the distance. There are four more thumps on the drone's underside, and then, instead of plummeting, we're rising once more. The smaller drones have buoyed my ride. But it's not enough. I'm about to shout that out when my ride strikes the top of the stone wall. Momentum carries me up and over, pinwheeling me through the air like a rag doll in low gravity. Except here on Cognata, the gravity takes hold of my flailing body and returns it to the ground with a vengeance. Through no effort of my own, I land on my feet, which shatter, along with both sets of tibias and fibulas and one femur. On the plus side, I manage to stay awake, and I have working arms, so I can drag myself several feet before I'm caught. I attempt to do just that, when I hear the great doors opening. When they do, my not-so-great escape will be over, and my very not-great escape will begin. There's no sign of Capria or the drones sent to rescue her, so at least she will live on. To what? Watch me be eaten from orbit? No. She and Gal will be back. They'll... My mind drifts. Gal is holding back. I can think of a dozen ways she could have ended all this long before things got nasty, which means she's already thought of hundreds more, and yet, this encounter is playing out to the most painful and dramatic ending possible. All of it orchestrated, or at the very least allowed by Gal. But why? Is it for her entertainment? Or for mine? Before the first cognatin can spill out of the opening doors, two small drones fly up and over the wall, the last of Gal's drones sent to rescue me. They stop on either side of me and Gal speaks through them both.
Grab hold.
What, are you serious? These drones can't lift me.
Lift you, Gal says.
I grunt in understanding. Gal's going to drag me. Since that is better than being eaten, I grasp both drones and hold on tight. I shout in pain as my still mending broken limbs are pulled across the rough ground. Every bump sets bones grinding, making healing impossible. I'm about to let go, the pain overwhelming, when the gates open and a 4-foot-tall army crashes out after me.
Go, go, go!
I shout. But the situation once again becomes hopeless. The Cognatins on foot are faster than the two small drones hauling my useless legs across the ground. The ones riding what looks like a cross between a horse and an elephant will be upon us in seconds.
We're not going to make it.
Gal's response is laughter. Always having fun. Still having fun. Just as the nearest Cognata is about to throw a spear down from the back of his massive steed, pinning me to the ground, the beast rears back, bucking its rider. Then, as though struck by a wave of invisible power, the whole dwarfish army flails backward, toppling over one another. Those that stay upright turn and run. What the hell? As Gal continues to laugh, I follow the Cognatin's gaze beyond me and find myself looking at the Galahad's massive hull. Without a sound, the massive ship shifted coordinates from orbit to just a few feet above the ground. Grunting in pain as my bones set and mend, I stand on my own two feet. I feel like I should say something to these people, try to direct their path. They are, after all, what's left of the human race. Instead, I turn my back on the lot and walk to the opening cargo bay door, where Capria waits beside a lander. Each step up the ramp is a fight, but by the time I reach the top, I'm fueled by anger.
Gal, we need to talk.
Later, Capria says, a smile on her face, hand reaching for mine.
As the doors shut behind us, she leads me away.
I've never felt so alive. I want to share it with you.
And with those words and Capria's alluring eyes, I forget about the conversation I planned to have with Gal for 500 years. 46. Is it Mount Danu or Danu Mount? I ask, looking at the tallest peak we've seen on Antarctica. I'm sure it used to have a name, and we could have Gal look it up, but we prefer to name things ourselves, and we haven't directly communicated with Gal in several years. Over the years, Capria and I have embarked on several expeditions to explore the continent that we share with a variety of wildlife, but no other human beings. Gal, controlling drones, joined us on our first few adventures, uncovering natural wonders that were once hidden beneath miles of snow and ice. But in recent years, she has stayed behind, the Galahad's lone occupant. The ship rests on the surface, our massive and modern city, should we ever feel the need for running showers, toilets, and food we don't have to grow or hunt. Without the ability to change Galahad's coordinates, the ship would have broken apart, punching through the atmosphere. Though Galahad was constructed in zero gravity, hackable reality allowed me to shift the ship's altitude, weight, and structural strength, allowing it to rest comfortably on land.
Danu Mount, Capria says, looking at the jagged mountaintop still miles away and too tall to scale without oxygen.
We're standing atop a cliff, surrounded by jungle, alive with sounds we've come to recognize. Monkeys, birds, and insects sing together, their song carrying a message of safety. If they fall silent, then we will too, taking to the trees if we can. There are predators here, descendants of wolves, bears, and big cats, which hints at humanity making their last stand on Antarctica, bringing the plants and animals that populate the continent before failing to survive. That's part of what we're looking for, the last vestiges of humanity. Not because we need to know their fates or are hoping for a still surviving human population, but because it's interesting. We're interested in digging up the past to discover the narrative of mankind's end, the same way archaeologists used to pull mummified corpses from the Egyptian desert. Eventually, when the rest of the planet recovers, we'll set out across the ocean and do the same with the rest of the world. Given the planet's size and our slow mode of travel, on foot, it should take up the better part of forever. And I'm actually looking forward to it. Are the pyramids still standing? Is the Statue of Liberty underwater? Is the Grand Canyon wider and grander? Or has erosion filled it in? We could answer these questions quickly with Gal's help scouring the planet from orbit, but venturing out on our own alone under the stars is far more romantic. You know it's a weird name, right?
You named the last one Willy Wonka, she points out.
It's from a classic novel. She laughs, her voice echoing through the lush valley below us.
It's the product of a drug-induced hallucination.
There's no proof of that, I say.
Except for the story itself.
I roll my eyes, but we have a variation of this fight every time we name something. It's become a fun routine, seeing who can come up with the most absurd title for the world's majestic sights.
What does it even mean, Danu Mount?
It's representational of this time in our lives.
She sits on the ledge, letting her feet dangle over 100-foot drop into a green canopy of trees.
You're the one who likes novels.
It's basic story structure.
I sit beside her.
I'm pretty sure nothing about our lives fits any kind of story structure.
Action, climax, you know.
So this, I motion to the mountain, is what? Mount Happily Ever After?
Hasn't it been?
She rests her head on my shoulder.
We've been here for just over 500 years. We're never hungry, never thirsty. Dangers are short-lived and normally just fun. Every day brings something new, and we're in love. After 500 years, still in love.
She's right. We live in paradise, and since one or both of us appears to be sterile, our responsibilities have been simplified to enjoying each other. We travel, explore, laugh, have sex, watch the stars, and rarely talk about the past anymore. After years of what could best be described as torture, we found peace. But is it enough? Forever?
Do you ever miss it? I ask.
Miss what?
I point at the sky. She gets it.
Oh, the endless void that is endless? That has a wall where reality ends? That has a planet where the inhabitants want to eat you and do God knows what to me?
That was the climax, by the way. Couldn't have gotten much worse than that.
She leans over the ledge, looking down. I tighten my grip on her bare arm. She'd survive the fall, of course, but it would hurt, and the idea of her being in pain doesn't sit well with me. There have been a few occasions, accidents, and encounters with predators that would have killed one or both of us if we were normal human beings, but surviving doesn't make dying any easier, or any kind of fun. Her arm, covered with slick humidity, isn't easy to hold onto, but there isn't much else to grasp. Her carry pack sits a few feet away. It contains food and water we don't really need, a bedroll, binoculars, and a single bit of modern technology, a solar-powered tablet that lets us map the world, record the names we give landmarks, read books, and watch old movies. Had she been wearing it, I would have held on to the strap, but since we've been here for so long, our clothing has been reduced to small loincloths and leather underwear, more to keep out parasites than a display of modesty. When she leans back, I relax. That is, until she asks the question, "Do you miss it? Are you not happy here?" "I have never been happier," I say. But even my ears pick up on the unsaid but. I lie back on the stone ledge, my now shoulder-length hair clinging to my beard. Capria leans over me, smiling, her confidence in our relationship and our life together unshaken by whatever doubts I might have.
"Go on."
"It's too easy."
It's not exactly an articulate response, but that's because she's waiting for more. I'm about to say more, but the words trigger forgotten memories, concerns never voiced, or just buried.
I shake my head. "That's just my own bullshit. Today is a perfect day, even better than most, and most are pretty awesome. I don't want to screw it up with hypotheticals and what-ifs that have the potential to ruin the day, not to mention the life we've built here."
"I think what I hear you saying," Capria is using her psychoanalysis voice, "it reminds me of someone I used to know, or imagined, is that you want to try something new, take new risks. Maybe it's time to try that boat we built."
It's a fairly seaworthy vessel, built using instructions from Gal's database. We considered learning the hard way through trial and error, but neither of us are instinctively handy. We built the sailboat using wood and animal hides. We then sailed the coast for several months, but never ventured out into the sea.
It's been 500 years, she says. The air could be better. Gal could check before we left. We could make Chile, explore South America, head north, see what became of Florida, pay our respects. See if FB can still conjure giant killer frogs. That gets a laugh. Some of the events of our now distant past have faded, but my nickname and the mutated frog that nearly made a meal of me have haunted me since. I guess. Everything she said sounds great. Perfect. Even the idea of fending off man-eating amphibians. But there is something off about it. About our story. Let the past go, Capria says. You have to eventually. Just live in the moment. She leans closer, smiling wide, and not because she's made a good point, but because she's letting her breasts rub against my chest. You know that thing? The subtle tension in my body fades into the background, along with my not-yet-understood misgivings. What thing? That you want me to try, she says, mischief in her eyes. My heart skips a beat. The thing I asked about 200 years ago? And just about yearly since. I gave up a few decades back. She shrugs. Well? I push myself up on my elbows. Seriously? Right now? I put a hand on her hip, already getting excited. Then she shakes her head and points to the sky. I'm sure she's watching. Gal doesn't care what we do or how we do it. She sits back, removing the warmth of her body and the promise of immediate gratification. Privacy or blue balls, those are your options. Come on, Will. Be my caveman. Find me a cave. We can take our time. Her words are intoxicating. I have a hard time thinking past the graphic images flitting through my head. Okay. I have rarely set about a task with such determination. Finding a cave isn't always easy. We found them before, usually to escape a monsoon. Several have dwellings built inside, ready to house us as we travel past. But we've never been in this part of the jungle before, so finding a cave takes some time. 3 days, to be exact. And as though fate had a sense of humor, the cave is located at the base of Denu Mount. It's large, cool, and happily unoccupied by predators or anything else. An underground river flowing through the back of the deep cave fills the darkness with a pleasant, baritone white noise. After realizing that I have in fact found a cave that would suit our needs, I breathlessly set about preparing it. I light the space with torches, lay out our bedrolls and furs, and cut flowers to make the earthy air smell sweet. Okay, I shout, voice magnified by the stone walls. Come in. Capria slips past the overgrowth, concealing most of the cave's entrance. She's silhouetted by the daylight behind her, but I can already tell she's naked. She moves into the firelight, eyes locked onto mine, and descends onto my body, hungry and willing. My mind slips into a kind of numb bliss. I lose all sense of time, of worry, and of life beyond the passionate darkness. And we stay in that place for what must be days, our genetically modified bodies having no trouble keeping pace with our ecstasy. When it ends, the torches long burnt out, and my years of pent-up desire satiated, I roll up behind her, wrap my arms around her waist, and close my eyes. You're happy? She asks. I nuzzle my nose into her back. The answer to that question requires no words, and I'm pretty sure has been expressed several times over the past few days. I'm glad. She rubs her back into me. Can we sleep? We don't need to. Haven't in quite some time. But a deep and dream-filled slumber feels like the perfect end to what we've just experienced. I squeeze her a little tighter, kiss her ear, and then after 5 deep breaths, I fall asleep. I don't know how long I've been asleep, but I smile when I hear her voice again. Will? I'm here. My voice sounds gravelly. My throat is dry. I might actually need a drink. I'm awake. I open my eyes to total darkness.
Where are you?
Here, she says, not far away. But when I reach her, I come up short. I turn toward the cave entrance, but see neither daylight nor the moon's glow, just total darkness.
Is there an eclipse, I wonder? Or thick clouds?
Neither feels true. We've kept track of lunar eclipses, and there isn't one due for a long time. Winter brings a solid month of darkness, but we're still in early summer. The days are long, which makes the total lack of light even stranger. I breathe deeply as a yawn overtakes me. The air tastes wrong, and it's dry, stinging my throat. My body tenses.
We're not in the cave.
Well, Capria says, her forced calm voice just barely masking concern.
Try to stay calm.
Those are pretty much the last words you should say to someone you want to stay calm. I sit up. The furs beneath me are gone, and I'm dressed, the clothing form-fitting and rubbery, familiar, but distant.
Cap, where are you?
I'm reaching out in the darkness, the floor beneath my feet as solid as the cave but now perfectly flat.
Cap.
A hand takes hold of mine, and I grasp with relief. I can handle a lot, but... Cap's fingers are short and strong. The slender digits in my hand are long and thin.
What's wrong?
It's Cap's voice, but it's not her.
You're squeezing me.
Who are you?
The menace in my voice frightens even me.
Damn it, Will!
Not Capria, but I still recognize the voice.
Gal?
You're not making this easy, Gal says.
You were imitating Cap?
What the fuck, Gal?
It starts to make sense. We're on the Galahad. Where is Capria?
Will, Gal says. I'm going to turn on the lights, but I need you to stay calm. It's important. I've never done anything to hurt you. You trust me.
While the first statement isn't technically true, I do trust her.
You have a body, I guess, figuring that's what she's brought me here to see. Could Capria have been right? Has Gal been watching us all this time, envious of our physical relationship? I finish my thought process aloud.
That's what you've been doing on Galahad all these years. Building yourself a body?
Among other things, she confesses.
Gal?
Will?
She sounds annoyed.
I'm going to turn on the lights. I need you to sit back down.
I know better than to argue.
I sit, my patience wearing thin in time with my desire to learn Capria's whereabouts.
Gal better not have left her out there alone.
Ready? Gal asks.
More than.
Light fills the room like a rising sun, gentle illumination growing brighter and shifting from orange to a full spectrum. At first, I see nothing. Then distant walls, a flat ceiling high above. The space is large and from a past life. I'm sitting on the VCC's floor. I look down and freeze. I'm dressed in a virtual skin. It looks old, worn, yellowed. Lying beside me is a VR headset and a face mask.
Gal?
I'm here, she says, her voice spinning me around.
I know the woman behind me, but it's been a long time since I thought of her name.
Sherry?
Gal, she says. But you called her Cherry Bomb.
Cherry?
Gal, what the hell is going on?
What did you do?
She falls to her knees beside me, reaching her long hands out for mine.
Well, I'm sorry.
I had no choice.
I pull my hands away.
Where's Capria? What did you do?
I had to stop it, she says, and I think she somehow lost her mind again.
Stop what?
The Great Escape.
47.
Reality implodes, ramming itself down my throat, shredding my stomach until I pitch forward and retch dry air. I heave again and again, the pain of my awakening shattering my insides until blood drips from my teeth. With tears, snot, and drool hanging from my bent-over face, I shout, "It wasn't real! None of it was real!" Gal crouches beside me, her hand rubbing steady circles into my back, occasionally catching on the tacky surface of my fetid, smelling virtual skin. She doesn't say anything, just does her best to comfort me while my mind processes the idea that I've lost 500-plus years of my life, of joy, of love, of Capria. After 30 minutes of weeping, my parched voice manages a single-word question. How? My memory sifts through the ages, focusing on the day I planned to launch the Great Escape but didn't. She misunderstands the question, points to the headset. While you lived in there, I lived in both worlds. I had time to learn, to create. My first body was synthetic. This one is living tissue over an endo, not you, I say, though I appreciate knowing how she has a physical body. The simulation. I don't remember it starting. If you remembered, you wouldn't have believed. Do you remember the words I spoke? Very well, Tom. She crouches in front of me, finger under my chin, forcing me to look into her blue eyes. The eyes I designed in the VCC. You were already in the Great Escape. It was for just a second, but it was enough. You never took the headset off. You only thought you did. Everything after that point. It wasn't real. You going crazy. Synergy. None of that happened. She gives her head a slow shake, lips pursed in a sympathetic frown. Why? Why put me through all of that? The pain. The anguish. That wasn't how I designed the Great Escape. You didn't design the Great Escape, she says. You designed me. I created the world you lived in. As for why, you wouldn't have believed a sudden transition to paradise. You had to suffer for it. Had to earn it. It was the only way you would ever believe it was real. Life aboard the Galahad out in the galaxy had to be fraught with pain and danger. It was the only way to get you to the denouement. To my happily ever after. My eyes sting as tears try to form, but I find my body lacking the moisture. Capria. Will, I shove Gal as hard as I can, knocking her back and lunging to my feet. My body aches with each movement, dehydrated from so long in the VR, but I push past the pain. Gal taught me how to do that after all. My memory of the Galahad's layout is shaky, but I remember the walls being well labeled. If I can find a lift, I pause in the staging area. My body is burning. The visa has cracked from my sudden movement. Some of the nodes are malfunctioning. Gal woke me up before I was ready, and I'm not sure I would have ever been ready for this. The virtual skin was reaching its single-use shelf life. The suit's failure would have shattered the illusion, and I would have woken up on my own. Is that why Gal pulled me out? To spare me from emerging from the Great Escape with a fractured psyche? I glance back at her, slowly following me, in no real rush to hinder my progress. She just looks sad for me. I notice her clothing for the first time. She's wearing dull gray coveralls, not the tight red dress I designed her with. Since she's not in a rush to stop me, I start to peel away my visa. The rubbery-turned, crusty material comes away in sheets. My skin is raw and red, but heals quickly. My healing, at least, wasn't part of the simulation. Why take us to the edge of space? Why did you reveal reality was a simulation? Because I knew it wouldn't be perfect. There would be glitches. And knowing reality wasn't real, I would write them off. But is this real? You mean, is there an end to the universe? She shakes her head.
If there is, we haven't found it yet.
Then this is real?
If I tell you that life isn't simulated, you won't believe me, because maybe it is. The only reality you can prove is simulated in the one we built together. You came close to figuring it out several times.
Her words trigger memories of questioning reality and a question I wanted to ask her but never did.
You borrowed from fiction. The algorithms did. Taking inspiration from the stories of humanity's past is a tradition as old as storytelling, familiar but new. Sometimes the system borrowed too much, and you noticed. And you're also easy to distract. Violence. Discovery.
Sex, I say. Why did you end it like that?
It was a gift.
A gift isn't supposed to hurt.
The words spill out over my trembling lips. I can still feel Capria's body against mine, smell her breath, her love. Gal took everything from me. But I never really had those things. It was never real. But Capria is. Virtual skin hanging in shreds, I head for the exit. The doors open at my approach. I make it a single step before stopping. For a moment, I'm lost, and not because the hallways look unfamiliar, but because they've been transformed. Massive murals cover the walls, floors, and ceilings. Those closest to me depict jungle scenes, most of which I recognize as places I visited with Capria, some of them with Gal. That's why she didn't join us, I think. She already knew what everything looked like. She created all of it. I move down the hallway, taking in the images. Gal stays behind me, a silent observer. While my destination hasn't changed, my pace remains slow. I can't help but look. These are my memories, like a photo album of the past 500 years.
This is like the tapestries, I say.
The Cognatins, Gal adds. They gave me the idea.
But you made them, I say.
An algorithm created them, based on a set of parameters, including 6 immortal humans surviving the landing on Kepler-452b, procreating and siring generations of people who would evolve in a world of increased gravity with a lack of technology, among millions of other variables. You could say that I chose the palette and canvas, but not the outcome. The Cognatins evolved outside of my influence. I was as surprised by who they became as you. I had to make it fun for me, too. I stop at an image of a vast desert. 2 small figures and a handful of drones are positioned by a line of graves. The ground behind us bulges as something emerges.
My brother?
Are you asking if his body is really encased in a petrified swamp? Gal says. You know I don't know. But that moment was real for you, FB. For both of us. Just because it wasn't real doesn't mean you can't.
You were giving me closure, I say. With Stephen, my parents, even Tom.
You wouldn't have enjoyed the denouement without it.
I shoot her a squinty-eyed stare.
You keep saying that word.
You're pushing me toward something.
Denouement. Capria.
This time when I start running, I don't stop. Years of faux history blur past, cruel reminders and fond memories, pushing me onward to face my worst fear made real. The lift doors close around me. There's no sign of damage from those ancient battles with Gal and Synergy. But there is a painting of Gal in robot form that startles me back. But then the doors open again, revealing a stark white, not yet painted cryo level. My run is reduced to a hobble when I pass the first cryo chamber and glance in. The beds are full, their glass fronts fogged over. The crew was never buried, never eaten by mutated Earth predators. How could I have fallen for such an absurd reality? Then again, how much more absurd is this reality? When I reach Cryo Chamber 2, my legs nearly give out. All 10 beds are occupied, their faces obscured by frozen moisture. I know what I'm going to find, but I run for Capria's bed anyway. The glass stings my hands, but I hold them in place until the water beads and drips away, clearing the glass enough for me to see through. The face I see is at first unfamiliar. The skin is pale, sickly, tight. But the bone structure, the hair, it's unmistakable. I stumble back and collapse to the floor, unable to express my despair. Capria is dead. Has been for a long time. Will, Gal's voice makes me flinch. How? A solar storm caused power fluctuations throughout the ship. She wasn't like you. Immortal. She never was. She died in her sleep. She never knew about Tom, about all this. Her death was peaceful. But all that time, I loved her. I don't know if I can do this without her. Gal squats down in front of me, reaches out to place a gentle hand on my cheek. You were never with her, Will. I flinch away. The words feel cruel, designed to cause me pain. Then she continues. You were with me. Her blue eyes are very different from Capria's deep brown, but hold the same intensity. Always me. Every word, every night, every adventure. It was all me. And I'm still here. I'm not going to leave you. Ever. All that's changed is the way I look. The way worry crinkles in the middle of her forehead, her slightly lopsided smile, the way she keeps reaching her hand out for my face. All of it conjures memories of a different face. Visually, she's different, but underneath the surface, what makes Gal who she is who Capria has been for the past 500 years. I'm not in love with Capria. The idea of her once, perhaps. But she's not the woman I've considered my wife for centuries. Never has been. There's a part of me, lost in time, that would have considered this outlandish, forbidden even. But that man didn't spend 500 years in a fantasy loving a woman who didn't exist, or who existed but wasn't the woman he thought. It's always been you. I take her hand from my cheek and squeeze it. That's why you woke me up. It wasn't because the system, or the story, or the denouement was failing. It was to be with me, in reality. To stop pretending. The great escape had to end sometime. Gal had waited until our relationship was such that I would still see her despite the change in body. I'm surprised to see tears in her eyes when she nods. And that's when I know the unwavering truth that Gal, the artificial intelligence turned very human intelligence that I created, in turn created a world for me, in which we fell in love. I don't think that was either of our intentions at the beginning, but that's what happened. Just because you're not in the Great Escape doesn't mean we can't have our denouement. Happily Ever After 2.0? I'm not going to lie, it's going to take time to get used to this. I motion to the ship around us and to Gal's cherry bomb body. But, yeah, you're still you. And I love you. Her relief over my acceptance of her is squelched by worry over something else. She reaches out both hands and waits for me to take them. When I do, she pulls me up and says, I need to show you something. I give Capria's corpse a final glance, the moment bittersweet, knowing that the real woman is dead, but the woman I love, who looked like her, is still alive in a new body. Then I'm following Gal through the Galahad's hallways. Gal sets a quick pace, glancing over her shoulder as I try to keep up. The first thing you should know is that Tom's firewall is still up. Shit. Seriously? Wick and Synergy never existed. Your progs are still working on the encryption. So, we're still cruising through empty space. That's depressing. Not quite empty, she says. But yes.
How far have we traveled?
62,523 light-years.
That stops me in my tracks.
The distance between Earth and Kepler-452b was 1,400 light-years, which at FTL speed, Galahad covered in just 10 years. In the 500 years I was asleep, we should have covered roughly 700,000 light-years, putting us outside the Milky Way and into an endless void, or one of our neighboring galaxies, Canis Major Dwarf or the Large Magellanic Cloud.
I run the math.
44 years? Time is different in the simulation. Raw data moves faster. Experience is altered.
Gal backtracks to me.
Why are you disappointed?
I suppose it means we're not much closer to cracking the firewalls.
No, she agrees. But I'm not sure it's necessary.
She motions for me to follow, and I do. We make a brief stop at the mess where I drink a half gallon of water. Then she brings me to the bathroom where I shower and shave. When I note that my hair isn't that long for 44 years, she reveals that when I was sleeping in the sim, I was actually unconscious in reality. She has changed my virtual skin, washed my body, cut my hair, and rehydrated me several times, all without me knowing, putting me back into the VCC and then waking me back up in the sim. When I'm fully dressed in gray coveralls that match hers, I ask, "Why are we doing all this?" Gal and Galis Capria has been fairly free with her body over the years. If it's just the two of us on the Galahad, why the clothing? There might not be a jungle, but I haven't seen much of a reason for modesty.
Making you presentable, she says.
And it's then off to the races again.
Fully hydrated, I have no trouble keeping up, and as my memories of the ship's layout returns, I realize where she's taking me. The observation deck. She doesn't slow down until passing through the doors into the large domed room. She walks backward now, smiling at me. Remember, everything we experienced in the Great Escape, aside from each other, was a simulation based on available data. It was a model. But sometimes, okay, a lot of the time, computer models get it wrong, right?
Okay.
Okay.
The dome blinks to life. I see the familiar endlessness of space.
Turn around.
I stagger back, eyes wide. It's a
spaceship, Gal says.
The vessel looks advanced, far more advanced than the Galahad, and it appears to be matching our FTL speed in reverse. I'm about to ask who they are when I see a serial number on the hull, stenciled in Latin letters and decimal numerals. My stagger pulls me back onto my ass.
They're from Earth, Gal says. Humanity survived.
For a moment, elation. And then, a memory. That serial number. NCC-1974. The number is different but similar enough that I know the sim is still borrowing from fiction.
Shit. No. This isn't real.
Gal looks defeated. She sits down across from me.
It can be. We can be.
She reaches out, takes my hand.
You don't want to go back, she says.
Capria?
Dead or alive, immortal or not, she's not your Capria. I am.
And I'd never know if it was real, would I? I am the creator of my own prison of infinite realities. Every one I peel back will lead to another, and I'll never really be sure if any of them are real. Unless.
A word flits to mind.
Hirith. I could end the sim.
Fudgel.
End Gal. In theory. Fudgel didn't work before, perhaps because my mind is so immersed that my physical body no longer speaks when I do. Without the command being spoken in reality, it has no power, and saying the words, if they didn't work, Gal would know I was trying to kill her. Not erase her programming, but kill her. Great Escape or not, Gal is an HI.
If the safe words worked, I could escape the infinite for reality. But would that be better? I could wait to find myself reduced to a brain in a jar, or Capria could be dead, and with Gal destroyed, I would be alone again. Or maybe Capria is alive but not immortal, meaning I couldn't or shouldn't wake her, and even if I did, she could hate me. If she's alive, I think. She's exactly where she should be until Tom's firewalls are beaten and control of the Galahad is reclaimed. Until there is hope to offer her, letting her sleep through the void is merciful. And who's to say life isn't truly a simulation that started long before I moved to Mars, or before Steven died, or before the dawn of mankind? Maybe all this time I thought my life was the story of me, when it was really the story of Gal. With so many unanswerable questions and endless possibilities, I narrow my thinking down to only two questions I can answer. Do I love Gal? Yes. Can I imagine living without her? No. Feeling a strange sense of freedom, I open my arms and welcome Gal into them. She kisses my neck, squeezing me tight, filling me with a familiar feeling of closeness, comfort, and safety. I love you, she says. No matter what you decide, I love you. My lips trace her cheek, her ear. And with tears in my eyes, I whisper a single word. 48. Engage. This has been Infinite, written by Jeremy Robinson, narrated by R.C. Bray. Copyright 2017 by Jeremy Robinson. Production copyright 2017 by Jeremy Robinson.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.